This is an interview by Carl Hartzell of President John Sampson Toe of the University of Maryland. The date is January 21, 1987. The interview is taking place at Dr. Toll's home in College Park. The following list of questions was handed to Dr. Toll while he and Dr. Hartzell were having dinner together at Dr. Toll's house. Questions for President John S. Toe. 1. What year did you come to Stony Brook? Old were you at the time? 2. From what institution and position did you come? 3. Who were primarily responsible for your coming to Stony Brook? 4. What was your position at Stony Brook, and who interviewed you for the position on the Stony Brook campus and in Albany? 5. Why did you come to Stony Brook? What factors were important? 6. What was your understanding of the purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook? 7. What was your impression of Stony Brook when you first came? The campus, the people, the leadership, the spirit. 8. What was your understanding of your own place in the future of Stony Brook? Why did you think you were appointed? 9. What expectations did you have when you came? What support was promised you by the central office? 10. How have these expectations worked out, both personally and for the institution? Did you and the chancellors work well together? 11. What events, what persons, what experiences stand out in your mind? 12. How would you describe your relations with the A, central administration in Albany, B, the offices in Washington, C, the national organizations of the disciplines, D, the governor's office and the Bureau of the Budget, E, the legislature. 13. What do you feel you had accomplished at Stony Brook by the time you left? 14. Why did you leave Stony Brook? 15. Can you name individuals who did things that were important for the future development of the university? 16. What were your major problems in the development of Stony Brook? 17. When you left, what did you think remained to be done to bring Stony Brook to the position originally planned for it? 18. Did your view coincide with that of the central office? 19. What comparative yardsticks were used in measuring Stony Brook's progress and achievements, state, national, international? 20. What other persons should we interview to gain a full perspective on the early development of Stony Brook? 21. What other comments would you like to make that would be helpful in the preparation of a history of the early years of Stony Brook? Some of these questions you can answer very quickly.
You want me to start right here?
Go ahead.
This is the statement by John Toe in response to the questions concerning the history of Stony Brook. First, I came to Stony Brook in 1965. At that time, I was 41 years old. But I had begun discussions with the Council of the State University of New York almost 2 years, the State University of New York at Stony Brook almost 2 years earlier.
Was it the Council or the faculty?
I had been invited to Stony Brook first by Dave Fox when they were looking for a dean of the graduate school.
Yes.
And that was at least 2 years earlier. Then I was invited back later by the council. The person I came from, a position as professor and chairman of the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Maryland, where I had served in that position for approximately 13 years, from January 1953 until September 1965. The persons primarily responsible for my coming to Stony Brook were formerly the chairman of the search committee, Dr. George Collins, a member of the Stony Brook Council, and the chairman of the council, Judge Sullivan. But I think that behind it were a group of faculty, deeply involved in the search, including Professor T. Alexander Pyle, as a prime mover, David Fox, and many others.
You knew Alec at...
I had known Professor Pond many years previously when we were both at Princeton University, and I had known many other members of the faculty at Stony Brook over the years through our mutual interest in scientific problems and teaching. I became president at Stony Brook in 1965 and continued to serve until 1978. I was interviewed at the position in Stony Brook by a committee of faculty and others, and particularly by members of the council.
Do you remember my coming down?
I remember distinctly meeting at Gala Hartzell and staying with you at the Oyster Bay location.
I stayed with you at your home. We had breakfast together.
Okay.
You remember that?
I'd forgotten that, but I do remember coming and staying with you and Ann Berry Mack and I at Planning Fields.
That was afterwards.
Then I remember that I went to Albany and negotiated with the group there. The key person in handling my visit to Albany was the provost, Harry Porter, but I also met with Mr. Murray, who was at that point acting chief executive officer for the State University of New York system, because this was during an interregnum prior to the appointment of Sam Gould. And I met with Murray, I met with Porter, I met with Foster, and I met with the director of personnel there, Dr. Price.
Yes.
And they were all extremely helpful and eager for me to come to Stony Brook. But I raised questions as to what the support would be and what would be done to assure the development of Stony Brook as an outstanding scholarly university. So Harry Porter asked me to write out my suggestions for the university, and I came back and wrote out a 43-page document, which I would be glad to find and submit for the history.
I wish you would. That's fine.
And that document was written with colleagues at Stony Brook over the weekend. I remember particularly that I spent a weekend at the home of T. Alexander Pond. Mm-hmm. Dr. Pond and they and others contributed many valuable suggestions. But I wrote out a long 43-page letter with suggestions of what should be done. And that letter was so demanding that it stalled negotiations. And I believe that the central administration and the State University system felt they could not agree to these atrocious demands, so they in turn asked that they be modified, and really negotiations came to a stall. I think they asked the council to propose other candidates, and the council responded that they found that this candidate and wished to have me appointed. But nothing happened there for a period of many months until Sam Gould was selected as chancellor. And then I was invited to Albany to meet with Sam Gould. And Sam had read the material that I had submitted and said that he would do the best he could, but he simply could not promise to meet the long list of suggestions I had made. So I picked a few as a test. I said, for example, would he support me in approaching to get someone like Bentley Glass as academic vice president? And I remember his response was, I would do anything to help you get Bentley Glass as academic vice president. So without any firm commitments, these are the matters that I had proposed, but at the same time, with the State University of New York early, I noticed that these were things we thought should be done. I did accept the presidency, and indeed did work even prior to my arrival at Stony Brook to bring some key people to the university. And I remember that spring when I was still at the University of Maryland, we did recruit Bob Kochman to be chairman of economics, C.N. Young to come first as a visiting professor, and to be willing to be our candidate for Einstein professor if we could get the Einstein professorship, which we later did. And in fact, on my first day officially on the job, we signed the contract for the Einstein professorship. And Bentley Grass to come as academic vice president, and several other key appointments. And basically, let me say, the State University of New York did live up to all the commitments or expectations that were created during my negotiations with the university. But I think the factors that were most important to me were first the firm commitment by the faculty and council and others at Stony Brook that they really wanted to make Stony Brook the finest research university that they could, and believed that it had the potential to become the really outstanding university that Governor Rockefeller and others wanted for the state of New York. And it seemed to me that all of the ingredients were there for building an outstanding university, support from the highest level of the governor down through all the people in the community and on the faculty. And it was that sense of shared vision which, to me, made the position most attractive. It's impossible now to remember all the factors, but I think there were many factors in place and had a sense that the planning that had been done was supportive of Stony Brook. There had been very good plans conducted by the Wells Commission, I believe that I already reported. The Wells Commission, if I'm right, had just issued a report outlining what's been needed.
Well, that goes back, the Hill report goes back to about 59.
Okay, yes, there was the Hill report, I guess I'm moving to the Hill report, and then there was a following Wells group.
Yeah.
And there was also a special group and a mirror for the medical center.
Right, that's it.
And
the report
that had come out just as I arrived.
63.
Right.
Came out in 63.
So, the plans were there. The objectives had been set in these various reports were transforming Stony Brook into a major university with a medical center. And it seemed to me the opportunity was indeed right to build in a way that would not be far from anywhere else in the nation, from where there were fields and woods and outstanding universities. And that was, to me, the tremendous challenge of Stony Brook and what made it so attractive. I also felt there was a very good core faculty there with a remarkable spirit, as well as many very able people. Many dedicated people, a tradition of good teaching, a dedication of students who've been through some strife, but we're now willing to all pull together in the interest of the institution. The expectations I have are best described in the 43-page document which we're giving you. I have to say the central office was very careful not to make any promises, but at least they knew what we hoped for and were willing to do what they could for us.
Did you have anything to do with Norman Hurd at the time?
Norman Hurd?
Hurd, chairman of the director of the budget.
I certainly met him that first year, and remember negotiating with him many times. I also remember a fellow named Martin, who was the budget analyst in the Department of Budget for the university, and he was indeed one of the unsung heroes of Stony Brook.
Oh, really?
Ed Martin, I think, was his name.
In the university?
No, under Hurd, in the executive division of the budget, who worked hard to get through the bureaucracy the things we needed. And Dave Price was another hero in the central office who worked very hard to get through things like the Einstein professorship and the details.
Hazen had already been...
Albert Hazen had already been recruited, but he was indeed the first distinguished professor at Stony Brook and set a model for our obtaining other distinguished professors. We then obtained Frank Young, Bentley Grass, and proceeded to acquire quite a few others. Major appointments as rapidly as we could. And then remember going to Europe trying to get P.A.M. Black, who eventually did come as a visiting professor. That was all in the summer of 1965, before I actually arrived at Stony Brook.
When did Lent Strumgren come?
Lent Strumgren also came and helped us set up the astronomy program. I think during my first year at Stony Brook, then, right? First or second?
Fairly early.
He used to visit us regularly, and he came as a consultant to help us in developing the astronomy program. And he was typical of the many scholars at other institutions who worked hard to give us the support we needed. I think we worked very hard to attract the very best people we could get, selecting very carefully only the very best people, knowing that often you have to go for many very good people to get a few. But I think we were fortunate and attracting enough key people in various disciplines to launch Stony Brook very rapidly into a level of national excitement, so more and more people like to come there. And was building a lot on the base that already existed. In my mind, the coming of C.N. Young was probably the most important appointment that we did. And that happened because of the fortuitous circumstance that Alec Bond was available to write very good proposals, that C.N. Young was willing to come. I remember visiting him in Princeton to persuade him to come. We've been friends for many years. And he was eager to leave the Institute and make a contribution beyond just what he could do in outstanding research through students and teaching and through setting a model at the new Institute. And we developed together a proposal, work for the visiting professorship, then for the Einstein professorship, then for the Center for Theoretical Physics, all of which were indeed appropriately provided by the state. But there was a lot of work that went in, hard work by many people, for each one of those steps.
Right. When did you go down and get from NASA, get from the NSF, a Center for Excellence grant? Remember?
Mm-hmm. Huh?
And what was
I
that?
I'd have to look up the exact timing, but we did spend every waking moment writing proposals, recruiting top people, developing plans for the university. Let me say, one of the most dramatic things I remember during that first year was the fact that the Murray Commission report had been written to found a medical center at Stony Brook, and that Murray's first statement to me was, well, you don't have to be bothered about that. We'll plan the medical center in the central administration. And I insisted that, no, the medical center had to be a key part of Stony Brook, and therefore we moved immediately, stealing money from wherever we had to set up a planning group to hold a national conference and immediately plan the program of the medical center.
I remember the conference.
And that conference was finally key in persuading Murray that the medical center should be part of Stony Brook and not a separate institution under its own separate administration, which I think was a key decision to made very early.
Yeah.
How did Steve
Was Pellegrino at that conference?
I don't know. I don't believe so. But Pellegrino was quickly identified as a good person to bring. I'm not positive. But I think Bentley and I together took the leadership in planning that conference. As I remember, one of the physicists doing the core work, I thought at the time it was a little radically unselfish thing to do.
You know which one?
Forgotten. Was it disaster? Or somebody like that. Worked very hard in planning it. Very unselfishly. There were a lot of people who unselfishly just did whatever had to be done. In the early days we did in Stony Brook, and there was a wonderful spirit of sort of, I think, the same way that existed in the time when the U.S. was being created as a new nation. A lot of people gave up of all their lives, energy and so on, for the common cause. So the excitement of building a new university captured the dedication and enthusiasm of the many very able, creative people who worked extremely hard in setting up programs in those early days.
So your impression of Stony Brook then was...
Well, Stony Brook was therefore a very lively university with a tremendous potential. When I first visited there, I think it had 1,800 students, and it never granted a PhD degree. It did grant the first PhD degree, as I remember it was in chemistry, at the first convention I attended, I think. But we were still just getting going. There were more graduate students in my department at Maryland than there were in all of Stony Brook when I went there as president. I mean, what, in my department at Maryland, yes, I had more graduate students than all of Stony Brook in those days. But the program quickly grew through a lot of hard work by many, many people. The two appointments in my... No. Yes, the two appointments in the early days at Stony Brook, I think I have to say, Frank Young was probably the most important appointment as our visiting professor, and then when we got it, the Einstein professor. So that clearly indicated to the world that we were second to none, and we could attract the very best. And he did. I think appointments like Kirkopolis were also important, because that was important. Feels like economics. I remember when there had never been an academic vice president in the senior system before, and we had to break all kinds of rules to get Bentley Graf appointed. He was appointed academic vice president for the academic year only, because although the salary was not high compared to what he could earn elsewhere, it was much higher than was paid to deans of faculty elsewhere in the SUNY system. But they were willing to make the appointment on an academic year basis and let us support him from research contracts during the summertime. An arrangement which was hardly appropriate for his demanding a job as academic vice president, but something he was willing to do because we could get funds, and he did do. I remember arranging to get him to come up and talk quickly to a faculty sitting as I lectures, and I remember so that we could go through his very rapid recruitment and then walking the papers through and getting approval for it.
Why did he come when he actually didn't have a full-time salary? I mean, you only had him temporary for a year.
No, he came on a permanent basis with agreement with me that he would serve as academic vice president and distinguished professor for 5 years, and then 5 more years as distinguished professor. And he carried through that commitment. So he actually retired from Johns Hopkins at age 60, and the Stony Brook, he was 65 as academic vice president, and then served for 5 more years as distinguished professor, and now is still at Stony Brook retired as distinguished professor emeritus, isn't he?
Right.
And came also as editor of the Quarterly Review of Biology, and when he came, he was president, simultaneously, of both the AAAH and Phi Beta Kappa. It was kind of symbolic that here he was a person who broadly was representative of the leadership of academia. And he did work very hard as a man who had been former national chairman of AAUP and for many years chairman of the committee A of AAUP to set up proper procedures to be sure that our academic appointments were done right. And that was something we very much needed.
Where did you,
as a new university.
When did you first meet Bentley Graf?
Bentley and I had been friends for many years. I used to joke that when I was here in Maryland, at the University of Maryland, he was at Johns Hopkins, that he was head of every organization I belonged to in the state. He was head of Maryland Civil Liberties Unit, he was head of the AAAS, he was head of Phi Beta Kappa, he was head of... I've forgotten many other things. I got him involved in the Federation of American Scientists, and eventually he succeeded me there as the national chairman. That was with some years break between us, but we had been involved working together on many national programs for the improvement of science, for improvement of science teaching, and so on, and we were good friends. So when I left the Stony Brook, I went to him and asked him, even before I had been appointed, would he be willing to consider coming as academic vice president? And he'd indicated that he would be willing, and that's why I put him at the top of my list in my negotiations with Albany, and he did in fact come at the same time I did, in the fall of 65, as Frank Young did too. Frank had been there the previous spring as a visiting professor for a month or so under an appointment from the New York State Foundation for Science and Technology, a visiting professor, and that was the time when we got him to agree if we get an Einstein professorship, he would accept it. And with his acceptance letter, we could write by far the strongest case that any institution could, and so won the Einstein professorship.
That was the first one awarded.
It was actually the first one awarded from one of the Einstein professorships because we had such a fairly good case. At least the first one filled.
What about the usefulness of Brookhaven?
And let me say, just as a curiosity, when we negotiated the Einstein professorship, that was very critical. Because the attitude of the State Department of Education was it would be their employee just located at Stony Brook. And I had to insist that no, he would be a faculty member at Stony Brook and they would contract with us to pay his salary. And we wrote a three-way contract between us and him and the State Department of Education, and I worked it out in such a way that the state paid his fringe benefits outside of the $100,000 for the professorship, so that augmented what we could get out of the professorship.
That was Alan, wasn't it?
That's right. Alan was then the commissioner, and I remember visiting him in his very lovely house in Albany, which was provided by the state, and negotiating part of this, and the associate commissioner at the time was a man named Frank Kelly, who was K-I-L-L-E, mm-hmm. who was extremely helpful in the work through those negotiations. And I remember having to carry the papers around from desk to desk and get this all arranged on time. But basically, there were everyone involved. Dave Price, Martin, so I knew we were doing things that had never been done before, but we're eager to help. And so even though the bureaucracy was rather heavy, everybody in the bureaucracy was time to see that it went through and did indeed help us get things that were needed. I would say Bentley Glass's appointment was very important. Then approximately a year later, I moved to have an executive vice president, and it was at the faculty's insistence that Alec Pond was appointed as executive vice president. I remember I was rather doubtful that two physicists should be in a senior position on the campus. Every member of the sixth committee and of the faculty said, no, Alec was the right person to do it. In fact, they felt they ought to do it. Otherwise, as chairman of physics, he would make the physics department too strong for the rest of the university. So after the wrong appointment, they did agree that his talent should instead be devoted to working for the university as a whole. Certainly, you wanting this child to stay on as administrative officer was one of the key things for the university. I remember that your agreement with the State University of New York provided that you could go back to Albany to serve there as administrative officer and effectively be my boss from Albany. And you said, no, you enjoyed it at Stony Brook and wanted to remain. So I went and asked, could you remain as administrative officer since you're all-around troubleshooting administrator for the university, particularly to handle relationships with the council and the community and particularly delicate matters, and they agreed. And I think that was tremendously important for the university. So your appointment, Matty Glass's appointment, and then slightly later Alec Pond's appointments were probably the most important administrative appointments made during those initial days. I think we better cut off now because I'm supposed to do the game.
You're down to questions.
Can you cut this off?
Let me do. Sure.
That interview was held in the Toll dining room while Dr. Toll ate supper quickly in order to go to a Maryland basketball game. We agreed to meet again Friday morning at 7 o'clock in the same place. Now let's see. Understanding of the purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook.
Well, shall we continue at that point? The Stony Brook was originally created as a campus at Oyster Bay at Planning Fields and was designated as the Long Island Center of the State University of New York. And its purposes at that time were not as fully enunciated as they were later. I would say the key points in the development of the statement of purpose at Stony Brook were the statewide studies that were done, especially the Heald Commission report, which urged that the campus be moved to Stony Brook and become a major university center with work through the PhD level and with a comprehensive program in arts and sciences and related fields. Mm-hmm. And the Hill Commission designated Stony Brook to be one of the four university centers of the SUNY system, which was definitely a change in mandate for the more limited mission that had been given to the Long Island Center of Planning Fields. The mandate was further extended by the Mill Commission, which said that there should be a health sciences center located at Stony Brook, which should indeed be a comprehensive health sciences center with major programs in the leading health professions. So that these programs, these